allegedly 300 million, but you know it's going to be a billion by the time they're done. And there's going to be Braille on every cell. So, you know, like, disability friendly. Every cell will be wide enough to let a wheelchair in. It's like, maybe, like, you just shouldn't be putting people in prison. Like, how's that? You know what I mean? So this is what passes as prison reform and what our governments are spending their money on. And then you're a bad person if you go, well, actually, I don't want you to build more beds, because every time you build more beds, you fill them. When there was only K4W for women, like Kingston Prison for women, there was only ever 42 federally sentenced women. Now we have 500, 600 federally sentenced women because we expanded into the different prisons and healing lodges, which were supposed to be in community, but they've continually locked down the healing lodges and made them into prisons. So, like, I'm just ranting here, but I don't have an answer to that. But yes, prison conditions are terrible. They're getting worse, and it's very hard to get attention to them. So if you are a prison organizer, you just have to be really gully with it. I think one thing is you really have to pick your side and side with the prisoners, and then not worry about, because what makes prison organizing hard is people want to organize for, like, the woman who shoplifted baby formula for her baby, but no one wants to organize about things like dangerous offender designations and lifers and stuff like that. And so we concede a lot of ground by being squeamish about you know, like, wanting innocence as a precondition for organizing. And that has, I think, allowed a lot of problems in how we organize as well.
Yeah, and the increases in policing, like, kind of also are necessitating, I mean, necessitating, but these increases in jails. And there was an interesting, I don't know whether this can be called, like, a slip up or an opening, but right now Crown attorneys in Manitoba are really mad, and they're unionized, which I think is funny and interesting. But they're mad because their workloads have increased. And up until this week on the radio, I hadn't heard it articulated as because of increased investments in policing. But this week, there was the president of, or something, of the Crown Attorneys Union was like, yeah, the government, in the budget of Manitoba this week, the government's commitments to more policing is going to make more work for us, which is essentially an admission that what dictates the crime rate is investments in policing, and that if we divested from policing, we could reduce the workload of Crown attorneys, we could reduce the jail populations. It's not about safety, it's about decisions about where to put these investments. And Manitoba, I mean, this NDP government loves the police. They just love them, and they will expand them in all sorts of ways, and that will then serve as a justification for the expansion of jails. And as we know, most people who are imprisoned in Manitoba right now are there on remand. They're there for less than a month at a time, often very short stays, and those short stays are deadly. They lose access to their medication, they, you know, have to miss work, they get pulled away from their families, it jeopardizes their housing, it jeopardizes their relationships with their kids, CFS involvement, and people die, and it destabilizes communities. So these investments in policing, no matter how the police are named as, like, care agents or whatever, I feel like I want to, like, officially predict that, like, in the next Manitoba budget, we also won't see the word police. We'll see, like, care agents.
My prediction was after COVID, they were going to hold a parade for, like, health workers and first responders, and the police would insert themselves. But
yeah, exactly. But yeah, like, all of that is actively producing instability, which is something that isn't captured in this NDP's tough on crime, tough on the causes of crime. Like, you can't have it both ways. Like, if you invest in criminalization, you are undermining community safety and stability, and you are not being tough on the causes of violence. You are stoking violence and insecurity.
And very quickly, in Nova Scotia, during the first wave of COVID, we were able to decarcerate 42% of the provincial jail population, including virtually all women. There was no spike in crime. For less than half the cost it was to keep somebody in provincial prison, we could provide full housing support, social work support, medication, etc. And so you'd think that would have broken the myth of prisons, right? Like, look what we could do. We let out 42%. We cut our population in half. We're back to higher than pre-COVID rates. So we have to understand that they tell us what we want is ponies and fairy dust, right? When we say we can divest in police and invest in communities, this is ponies and fairy dust. This idea that we can put all this money into this system that has never worked to prevent crime, doesn't create violent interventions, doesn't heal, doesn't prevent harm, and just, hey, like, the last $50 billion didn't work, let's stick another $50 billion into it. Like, that's ponies and fairy dust. That is radical. That is We're not radical. That is radical and out-of-step thinking.
You folks are really lucky to be hearing from Bronwyn and Elle, and thanks for sticking around. I want to turn it over to you now and see if you got any questions.
Hi, thanks so much for this panel, of course. You spoke to a lot of frustrations that I think a lot of us have had recently. There's understandably and rightly been a lot of emphasis on the policy actions of governments, particularly and shamefully NDP governments, as we see here in Manitoba. The same could be said in BC, in Alberta, etc., particularly BC recently. I'm wondering what can be done not only to intervene in these specific policy decisions, but the seemingly incorrigible fealty that, the police and the police lobby enjoy from the majority of the general public. Is this just a consequence of kind of settler fascism that will always produce these effects of, you know, that lead to this type of policing? Or are there specific contemporary factors that are exacerbating it or that can be leaned on in some way to interrupt this kind of resilience that police support seems to have? Because that's part of the issue. It's not just that the government empowers the police, it's that the government so often feels like it will be politically rewarded for empowering the police, because such a large percentage of the public seems to buy these narratives about the effectiveness and the comfort of policing.
I think that's somewhat true, but also not, because I don't actually know that the general public supports policing. I think we've actually seen those numbers massively drop. Even white people now admit that the police racially profile and they're, you know, unpopular, especially generationally. So I think, as with most things, like support for Israel, policing, our elite government classes are increasingly out of step with what the average person thinks. The average person knows this is bullshit, you know what I mean? Now, they don't obviously, yes, like they still accept narratives like bad people go to prison, and if you don't want to go to prison, don't, like, yes, those kind of narratives, because we're saturated in a media landscape, like Paw Patrol and, you know, prison Lego and stuff that just from birth teaches us, you know, this binary narrative. But I actually think support for the police has drastically dropped, which, remember, the support police in itself was a fiction, because people never supported the police, and that was literally a Hollywood project through things like Dragnet that made people support the police. And people don't naturally support the police because the police fuck with, like, what you want to do in your life, and people don't actually, like, people want to smoke weed freely and, like, not be police because they threw garbage somewhere, you know? So people's natural instinct is to not support the police, and it's actually a sort of psyop and, like, shock and terror awe thing that we do. So I actually believe that normal-minded people agree, but our political classes are increasingly out of step with what we want on war, what we want in foreign policy, what we want in terms of how our money is spent. And so I think that's, I believe that that's where we have a possibility for organizing. I do think that people instinctually in many ways get these things. It's just, how do we take that? Because the right wing also mobilizes these things, right? And this is what Stuart Hall talks about, like articulation moments, right? It's not that people just develop class consciousness and immediately become Marxists. Sometimes people start to develop some consciousness and the populist right comes into that and intervenes in this. And we've actually seen this in Halifax, where there's this guy like Shep something or other that's like a Charlie Kirk guy. But he has a lot of women that kind of join. And when I ended up talking to them at protests, these sort of fascist groups are showing up. A lot of the women in particular just knew that shit was wrong in their lives, you know, and that was the first voice that got to them. And then when you actually talk to them, like, it was clear they didn't really have a political understanding, but somebody had told them that the reason why grocery prices were high was immigrants. And you can actually talk to them, and some of them came back after and were like, oh, thank you, and yeah, I wasn't cool with what he was doing, and I'm actually Mi'kmaq, and, like, I just joined, this is my first political, and, you know, like, so you can actually intervene. And so we have to believe, if there's a possibility for the right to come in and shift things, it means there's a possibility for us to come in and shift things. And we have to be willing to do that work. So I think, yeah, I think we have to, like, again, believe that this media power, it doesn't actually have the power they think it has. There are ways that we can enter into that.
Yeah, Absolutely. And I think, I think people being told that the majority of people support the police, like, I think it's fair to say that a lot of people would say, I feel unsafe and therefore I want more police. But when you talk to people about what they mean when they say they want more police, they're like, the things they want are not things police can offer. So that is a very important moment for, like, kind of consciousness raising. And people either have ideas about the police because of what they've been told, because they haven't had interactions with the police, or if they've had interactions with the police, they know that the police can't give them what they want or what they need. You know, they don't deliver justice, they don't deliver protection, they don't prevent things. I don't think that, like, a crisis necessarily, like, gets so bad and then people necessarily become, like, politically conscious, but it is the case that, like, the drug poisoning crisis, for example, like, almost everybody knows somebody and loves somebody who has died because of the drug poisoning crisis. Like, everybody knows somebody who's been sexually assaulted or who's suffered gender-based violence. Like, people have intimate experiences, and there are ideas about race. There's, like, racism intervenes to make us believe that our experiences are somehow different from the experiences of the people who are being criminalized for those things, but, like, it's not a long walk, like, to build solidarity around those. You know, this issue with campus security, for example, like, in the wake of the Frances Widdowson visit to campus, it became acutely clear in ways that were already clear in many ways, like, leading up to this, you know, racist graffiti, like, just general racism and insecurity and gender-based violence on campus, whatever. But, like, it was really acutely clear in that moment when Frances Widdowson came to campus and campus admin and campus security did nothing to protect people from her visit. Like, she shouldn't have been allowed there in the first place. Security did nothing to protect people from the, you know, aggression of her supporters who were there flanking her, like, leaning into people, etc. And, like, since then, and I don't want to say too much, but, like, in order for example, like, the university just had this Indigenous cluster hire. Like, the question, as Donis has been able to reframe it, around, like, what would it actually take for the university to be organized in a way that kept her and other Indigenous people on campus safe? And then building from there, thinking about what security means, like, that is very palpable, it's very powerful, it changes our idea of what security needs to be and what it needs to do. Right now it's organized around locked doors, keeping people out of, you know, spaces that they could be connected to, and it's not organized around helping women with their safety plans to protect themselves from their stalkers or their, you know, sexual violence, whatever. But, like, this is what people mean by, they say, like, if we can organize the institution to make Indigenous women and girls safe, everybody will be safer. When Black Lives Matter, everybody lives better. And to the extent that, like, the carceral state is expanding into everywhere, that means that everywhere is a site of resistance, potentially, right? Everywhere is a site of organizing. I think we need to organize, we need to scale up, of course, but this idea of like, organizing people and trusting them with the capacity to know the difference between when they're being lied to about what safety is versus, like, what actually feels safe and provides safety, I think there's real opportunity there. And, you know, unions could be that place too. if there were union leadership that took workers seriously, maybe the nurses or the librarians or the transit workers would be organized around better public services rather than more policing at public services.
I have a Frances Widdowson story, but it would be too long. But suffice to say, I jacked up Frances Widdowson in, like, 2014. I was on her
bullshit. What do you mean you jacked up?
So in, like, no, I have to tell the story. The first day I was working at the time, not in a tenure job. It was, like, sessional at Mount St. Vincent University. And I was, at the time, they still allowed us to photocopy our syllabi. And so I'm, like, running off a bunch of syllabi, and I'm sort of wandering around the hallway waiting, and I see on the door this thing like, what was it called? Academic Free Speech Society. And he had posted this article by Frances Whittison. And I was like, what is this bullshit? That's like, right. I'm being microaggressed on my literal fucking first day at work. So I went and researched them. And then one of the things they published was Frances Whittison whining about how, like, you know, people don't think, like she's being persecuted for, like, her view on residential schools. And then a few months later, St. Mary's University brings her in under the guise of having an event about pseudoscience. So all these people, like, validate this event, but I knew what this bitch was about. So I went to the event, and I remember at one point she was like, Indigenous people want us to believe in dreams. Like, indigenizing the university means that you have to believe in dreams and ghosts. And I was like, do you teach Freud? Like, Freud believed in dreams. So it was just me for, like, an hour, like, interrupting her and arguing with her.
There are different strategies for dealing with her. And, like,
then she invited me to debate her at Mount Royal. I forgot about that. But then I went to Jamaica instead.
That sounds wise.
I was like, yeah, I'm going to come. And then I just didn't show up. I went to Jamaica.
That's a good one. Yeah. That would have made her real mad. But yeah, like this idea that, and you know, I want to do like the most generous reading of this possible, but the idea that engaging her is a distraction and that we should just ignore her, not say her name. Like, I think that... that almost centers her project too much. Like, it's not a distraction to, like, go create a space or stand beside survivors who, you know, I feel like what I heard in that panel, another message was, like, follow survivors. So it's like, if survivors are going to go out there and speak a truth, or as Donna has taught me, follow the grandmothers, stand beside them, and then you make it not about Frances Whittison. It's about the beautiful resistance, like the capacity for people to come out. Like, the university did shit all to de-escalate that situation, but so many people were working together, warrior societies, grandmothers, there was a round dance happening, people were checking in with each other, protecting each other, people were making that space safe, they were transforming it to be about, you know, what it was about, which is, like, Frances Whittison's not the only white supremacist. It's standing up against white supremacy and residential school denialism that we know is not only exemplified by the presence of her, but by the refusal of our university to take it seriously.
Thanks for the question. Thanks for the responses. We have time for one more question from the floor, but it's got to be kind of a quick one.
And we got to do the
impossible. You can't shut us up.
We do have a special surprise at the end of the session.
Is it Wab Canoe?
Just kind of a quick one. You were talking about, Bronwyn, about the NDP and police and prison expansion, and obviously that was a major focus of the previous NDP government.
Yeah.
But we also had two terms of a conservative government here, and from what I recall, at least in the first term, they didn't really talk a lot of tough-on-crime stuff. That I recall, they didn't push on that in the first part of their when they were in power. But like, what would you see would be the difference in the similarities between the Conservatives and the NDP when they're in power here provincially on that issue?
Well, briefly, the Conservatives divested from policing and jails under their austerity spending, and like that's not preferable because their austerity spending obviously also they divested from so many other like life supporting capacities. But then when the NDP came back into power, they reinvested in like the bail breach squad and jail beds, etc., but not equivalently reinvesting in all the like life-affirming capacities that the Conservatives divested from. And that's why we have this scenario, which is like just intensive policing of intensively poor people.
Okay, thanks everybody for sticking around.
Wait, Elle has a poem.
I know.
Oh, I'm sorry,
Andre,
that's a surprise.
Andre, hang on. Just hang tight. Elle, over to you.
All right, can I take poet privilege and do two? Or are we all like have to pee really bad or something? All right, okay, the first thing. This is my epic poem about the Winnipeg police. Winnipeg police only bring you grief. They can't keep you safe, can barely solve a case. Wouldn't search the landfill, but they'll investigate graffiti. Between killing refugees and violating treaty, their officers are creepy. Being caught downloading pornography while they are on duty. Stalk and beat their spouses. Break into their houses. Aren't you glad you give them thousands? They rake in on overtime to police the grocery aisles and arrest us for Palestine. Their headquarters got flooded, and that's a major crime. And now they give them body cameras on the taxpayer's dime. Winnipeg police lodge some guilty pleas on bribes and shady deals, selling drugs and stealing weed. Then they claim PTSD. Look what Constable Bostock achieved. He stole evidence from crime scenes, texted a picture of a dead Indigenous woman to his team, shared confidential police information as routine, fixed traffic tickets in exchange for drugs and liquor. Or perhaps did you consider that they won't search the Red River for your missing daughter? The former city CAO was investigated for corruption on the building contracts for headquarters, the same one that sprung a leak. Think of all the palms they greased. They commit crimes in their sleep and get off without a peep, but when Indigenous teens rob liquor stores, they shoot them when they flee. Winnipeg police, let me tell you about the chief. Couldn't find one allegation free. Every single one's a thief. Every single one's a racist. They kill people with their tasers. And now they want new stun guns and some foam rounds as replacements. They took a canine to an elementary school that bit a five-year-old right in the face. The IIU is a disgrace. The police board is a failure. They bury the complaints and call our protests hatred. It's long past time we face it. It's easy to replace them. Think of all the money wasted, all the robot dogs they fleeced. They're not officers of the peace. They don't serve communities. Winnipeg police, the budget will increase, and Wab Canoe will wear his button that says, I heart the RCMP, and they'll survey you in the library and stop you on the streets and hike the cost of transit, and you can't buy groceries. They'll get themselves more weapons while you get child poverty. And let's not get into all the officers with white supremacist beliefs. Winnipeg police, better hide your niece and your nephew, too. Don't know what they might do. I mean, they shot a kid or two, maybe more than three, so don't let them come recruit. Don't allow them in the schools. Avoid the boys in blue, because all of that is true and worse in history. I didn't even get to Starlight Tours. There's so many more receipts, so many violations of the charter. Let's remember J.J. Harper. For God's sake, can we abolish before they create another martyr? Sociopaths in body armor, allowed by law to harm you. They only serve elites, terrorists on the beat, the Winnipeg police. All right. And since I don't want to give the police the last word, we'll do this poem to close out the conference, because I'm taking poet privilege and hogging the stage. They've come down with shields to clear out the fields, the parks, the bridges, and automobiles. With their court-run injunctions and municipal... They've come down with shields to clear out the fields, the parks, the bridges, and automobiles. With their court-run injunctions and municipal deals to keep the undesirables tightly concealed out of mind, out of sight, is the way that they feel, and the ones that they serve are the rich people's needs, and the ones they protect are the property, and the tourists don't want that outside the library. They came round before sticking tickets on tents, and now they say camping's a bylaw offense. And since they gave warning, the cops can commence to clear the unhoused and put up a fence and arrest the protesters who try to prevent. Most of them don't know when they'll stop paying the rent. When the occupancy rate's over 99%, outside capitals making the values ascend, pipelines run through Indigenous lands, no consent. Single mothers, they struggle to stay in the projects, and when she's evicted, nobody objects. It's a landlord town, so you take what you get. And your taxes go to some CEO stores who's hiding his profits and accounts offshore while they spend millions to search out welfare fraud, claiming the problem is really the poor. They say that the symptom is really the cause, and so they proclaim they won't change the bylaws. Though they change them for restaurants to expand their patios, for bourgeois to consume their $15 Cosmos, but these are the places that politicians go, wined and dined by developers who put up the condos beside the gourmet donut shop or the dog grooming parlor. They brag that the cranes rise high above the harbor, while life for the average gets harder and harder. Reserves in this country still don't get clean water. Migrant workers abused by the farmers, black mold in the housing, debt getting larger, but the corporations booking another record quarter. Ford comes back to power, no mention of murder in the long-term care homes and hospitals caused by neglect. Inflation is up, so they say tighten your belt. Why don't you just play with the cards you got dealt? A one-room apartment in a rat-infested cellar. It's a Russian roulette to find a bed at the shelter. Nursing home has no staff to take care of the elders. Workers give you a tent and say they just can't help you. Or let's send you to prison where they say you'll get better. And plus, jail expansion benefits private investors. Cities can't even pay for a garbage collector. There's money for cops and a new dispatch center and money for prison and money for weapons like Oliver Twist. You best not ask for seconds. Your kids are too hungry to do well in your lessons. You can live in your car if you avoid repossession. A succession of governments, and change is just fiction. Landlords gear up for another eviction. By all definitions, you'd say this is crisis. Housing is supposed to be where human rights is, but they've sold off our market, so poverty cycles, and those who to govern seem like they despise us, and populist grifters come in like they're righteous, and revel in rhetoric used to divide us, knowing that people together can rise up. In my city, the cops often cover their badges and clear the encampments wearing thin blue line patches. We know this is warfare between the classes, the 1% versus the rest of the masses. Folks burn up in shelters. Parliament lit the matches. Decades of austerity leaves us in ashes. They say to understand power, just follow where the cash is. But they're flooding the streets with their Amazon Prime. What they're doing to the water, that should be a crime. It's a lie there's a ladder we're able to climb in a world where the morals are, well, I got mine. And they say that this earth doesn't have that much time. So shout out to the carpenters and to the builders who make tiny shelters in defiance of killers, who treat unhoused people as though they're just fillers in a capitalist system of losers and winners. Shout out to the treaty truck house by the river. Shout out to the grandmothers and the gorillas who know that all that is gold doesn't glitter, and all that we need, it cannot be delivered. Except when we organize, becoming a mirror where in each of us solidarity lives, and that we are given, we also will give. And we won't be at home in injustice. When one of us is threatened, we all will resist, and we have. And we do. And we once again will. As long as their coffers continue to fill, for all of our neighbors will die on that hill. For the world that we want, it is possible still. The world that we want, it is possible still. The world that we want, it is possible still.
You've been listening to Harbinger Showcase on your local campus and community radio station. We'll be back with another conversation from the March 28th Winnipeg Progressive Public Symposium next week. Until then, I'm Harbinger Director Andre Goulet in Montreal. Now back to your regularly scheduled community radio station programming.
This is Thurston. You're listening to CJSF 90.1 Burnaby. Yeah, I'll keep listening.
Breathe easier with a new Tech2Go item. Carbon dioxide monitors, now available at your local Surrey Library branches. These easy-to-use CO2 monitors help check indoor air quality and beep when carbon dioxide levels increase, letting you know when it's time to open a window or to step outside. The monitors can be used at home, in the office, in the classroom, or in the car. The monitor also shows the temperature, humidity, and air pressure of the space you are currently in. With a CO2 monitor, it's easier than ever to make quick, simple choices to bring in more fresh air at home or on the go. Try one now and see how good ventilation supports comfort and well-being. Borrow a CO2 monitor for up to 21 days. Your kit includes an RNET 4 CO2 monitor, a quick start guide, and a case, available to pick up at any Surrey Library branches. Borrow a CO2 monitor today and start breathing easier. For more information, please visit surreylibraries.ca/tech-go to see the full collection.
CO2 monitors are not carbon monoxide detectors and are not life safety devices.